Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Today, we are talking about the future of resistance to Trump and the lead up to the confirmation hearings this week, what the politicization of the Golden Globes mean, and the outlook for protests at Trump's inauguration. But before we can move on, Dan Coats, President Trump's nominee to be the Director of National Intelligence, has been described by some as the, quote, Mr. Rogers of the Senate. In fact, by all accounts, he is just an all-around nice guy. And this, of course, has been trumpeted by the media, who are noting it primarily to say it's a break with Donald Trump's style, given the fact that he is not really known as a nice guy. Well, Senator Coats may indeed be a nice guy one-on-one, but when it comes to his policies on intelligence issues, he is pretty hard line. One week after Edward Snowden's documents hit the media world, Coats took to the Wall Street Journal to denounce Snowden and the leaks. He stated that the programs were, quote, legal, constitutional, and used under strict oversight, close quote, which is pretty ironic because just a couple years later, the courts ruled explicitly that Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act, under which the NSA was collecting bulk phone records, was in fact illegal. Coates said the program was necessary because it could stop attacks on the United States. Here's the problem with that, though. It turns out the NSA's mass spying actually was never linked to the thwarting of any terrorist attacks. Yes, that's right. The NSA can't actually prove that their massive spying on all communications on the planet is actually working. And in fact, some have argued the sheer amount of information they take in makes it more difficult, in fact, to stop attacks because it creates a needle in a haystack type of situation. Coates also supports Guantanamo Bay continuing to be used as a prison camp. And as it concerns torture, well, Mr. Rogers also appears to be okay with waterboarding, as he told the press in response to the release of the CIA torture report that it was a, quote, partisan account, end quote, despite the fact that the Senate's report was based on the CIA's actual documents detailing exactly what they did. When you put Coates together with Mike Pompeo, the nominee to be the head of the CIA, it's a pretty terrifying sight. Pompeo has actually called for Snowden to be executed and feels the exact same way as Coates about the government's panopticon-style surveillance. It's also worth noting that the brother of Trump's nominee for the Department of Education is Eric Prince, one of the premier dark operators of the American intelligence world. So clearly, Mr. Rogers' neighborhood will be chock full of pro-torture, civil liberties hating, former congresspeople for the next 4 years. Over the weekend, U.S. Special Forces launched a raid deep into Islamic State territory. They captured and killed some Islamic State leaders, allegedly, but that isn't what's really notable about this. The bigger issue is how it reveals, again, the fallacy behind the, quote, no boots on the ground philosophy that American politicians trumpet over and over. Well, there are boots on the ground in Iraq and Syria, and in Iraq, there are actually 5,000 of them, and this really is consistently misportrayed in the U.S. media. These troops are portrayed as quote-unquote trainers, way out of harm's way, and, you know, just helping Iraqi and Syrian rebel forces get their footing, as it were. The reality is totally different. For instance, in Iraq, U.S. troops are playing a major role operating artillery to support Iraqi forces' advance against the Islamic State. They're also providing spotters for airstrikes. And in any modern large-scale offensive, these are not side pieces, but the necessary ingredients to give the Iraqi military the edge they need to defeat the Islamic State, which on their own they were signally failing to do. And it's also been clear for some time now that in both Iraq and Syria, U.S. special forces are directly involved in the fighting. The scope and the extent is not known, but it's clear that SOCOM is involved in much more than simply teaching people how to shoot and rappel from windows. Ultimately, what's happening here is pretty clear. It's classic mission creep. Significant sections of the Pentagon have argued since 2008 that there shouldn't be any significant withdrawal of U.S. forces from the Middle East. They failed in accomplishing that goal completely and now are seeking to backdoor their way in. The feebleness of the Iraqi military provides the excuse to train, and given how the training isn't doing much, it increases the excuse to provide critical mission support in special forces. And when that isn't going well sometimes over the next year, it's also going to provide the excuse to at least attempt to send large numbers of American forces in to deal with ISIS or whoever directly. Either way, the reality is there are boots on the ground, Americans are fighting, some are dying in Iraq and Syria, and the strategy of deepening the conflicts in those two nations still isn't working. Might be time to revive that old slogan, bring the troops home now. We talk a lot on this show about the impact of climate change. And one thing we mention often is that species on this earth could go extinct sometime in the near future. It's coming home sooner than we might expect. However, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced today that if significant action isn't taken on climate change sea ice continues to collapse, that in the near future, 80% of the polar bear population could disappear, maybe more. The natural habitat of polar bears is shrinking rapidly as sea ice continues to go by the wayside. And while this may seem like a small thing to some degree, it really is quite stunning to think about. Polar bears, literally one of the most iconic animals on the planet, are dying off due to climate change. Two generations from now, the polar bear could be considered something like the woolly mammoth, if there are even any humans around at that point. Climate change is real, and it's deadly serious. Maybe the fact that a beloved animal may cease to exist will shock government officials into action. Seems like, given that Trump's cabinet is stocked full of climate deniers, that isn't likely to happen, though. So if the polar bears are going to be saved, it looks like it's up to us. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are joined in studio to continue our conversation by Anoa Chenga, the host of The Way with Anoa, and also frequent guest and friend of our show here on By Any Means Necessary. Anoa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, as always.
Of course, of course. So it seems like here we are, Monday. Big news this week is going to be, most likely, the confirmation hearings. And I guess Trump is going to have his first press conference. So that's where I'll start. Sessions, Jeff Sessions, Trump's nominee for the attorney general, seems to be the big sort of banner one. He's getting his own day tomorrow on Tuesday. There's the protest happening on Monday with Reverend Barbara Moore on Monday. Lots going on around Sessions. I mean, it's just so interesting to me that this guy was not confirmed for a judgeship in 1986. And it looks like he may, in fact, be confirmed this year. I mean, it just seems like this is a real sign, if nothing else, of how far right the country has moved since the Reagan era.
It's not just a sign of how far right the country has moved. It's also a sign of how much Trump really does not care about actual enforcing rights and legal protections for people. And it's definitely about upholding, you know, things for a select few. I mean, Jeff Sessions becoming the attorney general, the top law enforcement agent in the country, it's abysmal. I mean, his record from civil rights, women's issues, LGBT, I mean, you can go down the list. There's nothing to indicate that he'd be even more forceful than our prior two AGs on issues involving the banking industry or other financial white-collar crime type stuff. So it's a peculiar choice, I think, even when you look at people who are on the right, who are, you know, who have been in this area to fill that position, but that's it goes along with everything in Trump's cabinet. It doesn't. It's like someone. I still feel like we're being punked, but mm-hmm. But here we are. And I mean, I don't know that the confirmation can actually be stopped. I was just told earlier that he is that as a sitting senator, he can actually vote to confirm himself in the full vote, which is. I've been trying to research that to figure it out, but apparently, because, you know, without his vote, then that 52 majority drops down to 51. So it's very, very close. And maybe you could flip a person or two. But no, for what I've been told, he actually can vote to confirm himself, which is insane. Right. And even though if he gets confirmed first, I think he can still vote to confirm all the other ones as well.
Wow. Well, that's I mean, it really is through the looking glass here. And I mean, I guess he's even on the relevant committee. So these are the people who are allegedly grilling mm-hmm. him are the people that he's been anyone who knows about congressional committees probably pretty chummy with over the past couple years.
That's true. That was a piece. His main advocate, I forget her name off the top of my head, is a Republican senator from, I think it's Maine.
Susan Collins.
And she – yes. Yes, 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 yes. And she's just like, you know, the whole thing has been, there's even a Democratic senator, I'm so horrible with names right now, but there's a Democratic senator from Delaware, Coons, I think.
Capper, one of them.
one of them, he was saying that, oh, but he's really nice, and we don't have to go all the way back. We don't have to bring up that stuff from the 80s. Like the reluctance of even the more conservative Democrats, because here's the problem, too, right? We keep saying, like, okay, if all the Democrats don't consistently do anything, because you have people like, you know, your more moderate centrist Democrats, really your fake Republican Democrats like a Joe Manchin, that are really going to be wild cards when you talk about these confirmation hearings and the ultimate confirmation vote once it goes to the full Senate. But Jeff Sessions is a huge concern, and the protests are important and crucial, but also getting people to call. People need to call. Don't tweet it. Tweeting at them is not going to do anything. We need people to call. We need people to flood congressional offices, you know, flood the senators. I think Move On, DFA, there are several organizations, I think, that have been putting out call lists of who the people, the must-call people are. So just call. Like, everyone needs to call and flood them in addition to the protest, because, you know, as much as pressure as possible that can be put on them, if it's possible, you know, to get Sessions pulled back. I mean, it's a gamble. We're not going to get them all pulled back, but he's definitely one that needs to be pulled back.
No, I agree with you. But, and also to some extent, I mean, isn't this really sort of the acid test for the Democrats in some ways? I mean, you know, they claim to be, you know, defenders of all that's right and good in the world. Mm-hmm. But as you just mentioned, mm-hmm. many of them are, you know, the more conservative are not that. And it just sort of seems like beyond whether or not, you know, the efforts of individuals to get it stopped will necessarily stop it, it seems like raising the bar of what people expect is also so key too, right?
Right, and I think that was one of the things that were posted. I know the NAACP Legal Defense Fund has been one of the major organizations that have been, you know, demanding ever since he was announced as the nominee to that people need to demand that he's grilled, that it's rigorous, that he doesn't just get rubber stamped and skate through. Because that also sends a bad message, right? And this whole thing that, oh, but he's really nice, because I've seen things like he's really nice, he's well-liked. There was a piece that compared his relationship with other more liberal members of Congress to the same with Kennedy and his relationship with people, with Ted Kennedy, his relationship. I think it's completely different when you have someone that, for lack of a better term, is a bigot. It doesn't matter how nice they are. You know, everyone talks about, oh, the normalization of Trump. The normalization of hatred and oppression and subjugation underrepresented populations has long occurred. And as we see in the Sessions in his very long history, the normalization of these things and issues that have given rise to a Trump have long existed. And I really caution everyone, as we're in this resist Trump phase, that we really got to pay attention that we're not just resisting Trump, that we're actually addressing these underlying issues in history. And I do think that even if this isn't successful, you know, I do think that people beginning to attack these vestiges of hate, it's really important, and it needs to be a continuous effort.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. You know, one other issue I wanted to raise too, you know, Trump has scheduled his first press conference on Wednesday, right in the middle of this whole thing mm-hmm. of hearings. I mean, it seems pretty much guaranteed to try to distract from the fact that, you know, negative things are going to be said about his cabinet nominees. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just makes me wonder about the media here. I mean, Trump is obviously trying to play them. Like this, it's not even whatever. He refused to do a press conference for 2 months. Now he's doing it at a time that can only distract from what he wants, what they would report on if he wasn't doing it. And right. I mean, it just makes me wonder, I mean, is the media just dumb, or are they, and to my view, more likely just in league with Trump because they want the ratings?
Well, I agree with the second part of what you said. I said that I don't think it's that Trump plays the media. I think the media plays themselves. And even as you see, like, you know, heads, editors and chiefs and heads of various outlets on Twitter can you know, throw out their liberal, progressive, you know, values and claim that they're the only ones really trying to do anything, when in fact, like you said, their outlets have spent so much time covering Trump across this entire election cycle. And now here we have a day, I think it's 6 hearings. I forget how many hearings it's happening on Wednesday. You know, we have Davros. We have so many people happening, and now Trump is going to do this. And no matter what he is or isn't going to say, we already know it's not the most important thing that's going to be happening. It's not the most newsworthy thing that's going to happen. But I see that there is a focus on, because the commodification of our news, right, like the ratings, like we had the head of CBS saying during the election cycle that Trump was good for ratings. Trump got how many, what is it, the value was like billions of dollars mm-hmm. of free coverage. They don't, it doesn't seem like the responsibility to people to get the news and get the word out. Like our news media, particularly so-called liberal media, could be a very strong arm of any type of movement activity building right now. And instead, they're really more detrimental than that. And that's why it's so important to support independent, you know, media outlets such as yours, such as, you know, Loud and Clear, such as my show and stuff, and others. It's really important to support those voices because we're not getting that same critical analysis and engagement that we really should be having on the national level otherwise.
No, I think that's 100% correct. And it just speaks to how, you know, craven these media people are. I mean, they would rather cover empty mm-hmm. podiums than cover a lot of the stuff we cover. They have 24 hours worth of news.
Well, they'd rather cover his Twitter rant.
Right.
Like,
right.
Who cares that he's upset about Meryl Streep and what she said last night? That is not newsworthy.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a lot of these news stations have really sort of taken a page from WWE, as Donald Trump obviously did as well, which is that what, I mean, we know entertainment sells over and above anything else. Certainly they could go, you know, try to go the extra mile, produce more programming, try to reach more areas of the population who feel like their stuff is not as out there as it's supposed to be. But instead, you know, they just go with the easy, lowest common denominator, which draws people in. But either way, that's where we're going to have to leave it today. That was Anoa Chenga, who hosts The Way with Anoa. Please check that out. And the whole Progressive Army team, as always, doing great, great work, which I think will be great for everyone this week as well. And as always, we will now be taking a break. Here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about some of the things coming up for the progressive movement in the face of Donald Trump, Meryl Streep's Golden Globe rebuke, but really what that means for culture in an era of resistance, and what everyone, including us, will be talking about all week, which is the confirmation hearings that the Trump administration's nominees will be facing in front of the Senate. And we are very happy to be joined for all that, and I am willing to bet more, by Winnie Wong, who's a founder of People for Bernie. Winnie, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure to be on your show, Eugene.
No, of course. Pleasure is all mine. And so, you know, looking maybe at sort of the broad sweep here of this showdown week, I guess, of confirmation hearings. They're all sort of stacked up here in the midweek. It's interesting to me to note, beyond sort of the individuals themselves, that the whole sort of narrative around, well, Trump is you know, anti-establishment or whatever it may be, that the Republican leadership has just gone all in on these nominees. They're saying they're pushing them all through. They're all going to pass. And I mean, it seems like maybe the Trump agenda may be more like the Paul Ryan agenda than perhaps was ever sort of mentioned during the campaign.
I don't think that at this point that there are any differences between Trump's agenda and Paul Ryan's agenda. It's a united GOP agenda, right? Like, this is not unusual. This is how they've always done it, and this is how they always win. That point alone should be the point that people who are organizing against the Trump administration should be thinking about as they're thinking about, like, ways to stop Trump and create conditions inside and outside that are extremely obstructionist.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty clear and pretty evident. Like, there's no disconnect between, like, what Trump wants and what Ryan wants at this point. They've chosen the people for these cabinet appointments, and they want to confirm them as swiftly as possible, and they'll unite to make sure that they do so. So what Democrats are doing now, you know, I see as a good faith effort, but I'm not entirely sure. And in fact, I know they won't necessarily be effective in stopping any of these confirmations from happening.
It's a good point. And it raises sort of segues into another question I have, which is sort of an interesting, I don't know if it is a paradox, but, you know, you look at Jeff Sessions, for instance, who is rejected as a federal judge in 1986. And now it looks like we'll see that he in 2016, he is going to sort of sail right through there more or less. I mean, many negative things will be said, but these, you know, people will vote for him. It just seems I guess on its surface, you know, the Reagan era, 86, seems like, man, that must have been a much more right-wing era than now. But this seems to just speak to the fact that if that is the case, in 86, the guy's rejected, and in 2016, he may be accepted, that maybe politics has moved a little further to the right over the past 30 or so years than perhaps we thought.
Well, certainly, because I think the structures of the Democratic Party have been severely weakened by the GOP.
Mm.
That's what we're really looking at here, right? I mean, I don't know if that seems too opaque or too, you know, sort of esoteric, you know, as a response to your question, but like, this is what is happening.
No, I think it's right. I mean, I think it's very right. No, you look at, I mean, sort of the context. I mean, to me, for the first thing that I think of, given that the first issue was the issue of Sessions, was the NAACP and the racist comments that he had made in 86, was my thought was I immediately thought of the quote-unquote sister soldier moment of Bill Clinton and sort of that whole shift from the importance of the civil rights establishment to sort of post-1964 Democrats being so rolled back. And even though we've had a black president, like here we are, I mean, I think the institutional labor, civil rights, and so on and so forth, you know, perhaps that's what's coming to the fore.
Well, I mean, I think what I'd like to see is a unity in the grassroots led by some of the institutions, with not necessarily led by the institutions, but like a coalition of outside groups and institutions coming together to actually like create like a scaled up protest of Sessions.
Mm.
I think that could be effective. But that hasn't really happened yet. I mean, I see like a lot of disconnect between, you know, some of the organizing that is happening in the streets, you know, kind of decrying his record and, you know, what he will do to the country, and particularly to people of color in this country and people who are impacted first and worst on frontline communities. So with that NAACP occupation in his office in Alabama, that was like on the surface powerful, but it didn't last.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a 6-hour, 8-hour, 10-hour occupation, sit down. It made a powerful statement. I think it got the NAACP some media, but wouldn't it be more powerful if the NAACP started like working with outside groups to create like, you know, a longstanding protest against Sessions and what that would like look like? I think that would have much more impact because they do have a significant constituency. And of course, when you marry that to outside, you know, groups who are also opposed to Sessions, because like if you really take a look at it, Sessions will harm large numbers of Americans. That's the bottom line. I mean, there's no debate about this. I mean, he's a racist. You know, when you have like a Democratic senator like Sherrod Brown calling him out and saying, you know, this is not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
This is not politics as usual. Actually, Sessions is a racist. Period.
Yeah.
And everybody should feel comfortable saying it, Democratic lawmakers included. You know,
right.
He's a racist. He cannot be the attorney general. We have to stop him, even though he might be confirmed. That doesn't mean that we stop stopping him.
Mm.
And that, I think, is a very, very important point that I want to make with regards to Sessions.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that is a very good point, sort of the continuity of resistance there. And then the other thing it makes me think of, too, you know, you look at Pudsner coming in here as the labor secretary, and then the sexist ads he had at Hardy. Mike Pence trying to jail a woman for having an abortion. I mean, Donald Trump and the video and everything. I mean, it does seem like it, in addition to race, I mean, as we hold the whole conception of patriarchy, sexism, gender, like we're going back to like almost a Leave It to Beaver type of mentality, except even worse because the stuff they put on TV is not even, it's not even coded like it was then, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the hyper-normalization of like misogyny and rape culture with the labor choice is so shocking to me that I'm not even, I actually can barely like process this information, right? Like it's like the message that it sends is hyper normalization of rape culture. And that's really the bottom line. Like these commercials are really unacceptable. And who's going to stop them? The FCC with Tom Wheeler stepping down? No, absolutely not. Right. There's so much that is actually bad that we're confronted with that it makes it even harder now to actually think about like a critical strategy that could stop these guys. But we're not going to stop trying. I mean, I think that's also a very important point that I'd like to make is that like there are those of us on the front lines, on the inside and on the outside, who are trying really hard to stop this insanity.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that because it sort of seems like, I mean, you know, looking at what Meryl Streep did last night at the Golden Globes and even stretching it, you know, sort of beyond her, you know, Colin Kaepernick, it's really been sort of an un- unprecedented, even, you know, who, I'm going to shout this person out again, Misha Barton, who people were trying to rip her. She had a great statement against the police, even though she was on a yacht when she put it on Instagram. I mean, really sort of a banner year for, you know, famous people, I guess, coming out and saying things. And it almost makes me feel for people who are looking to organize resistance. It almost feels a little bit like how you paddle on a surfboard in advance of the wave that, you know, I don't know if how many people are directly connected to these artists or if they're just doing it because they're people of conscience or whatever, but that sort of the idea of quote unquote resistance is gaining currency in the culture. It seems like that's what's reflected by the Kaepernick, the Meryl Streep piece and some of these other things.
Well, I think we have to think about influence and resistance, right? And I think Meryl Streep understands that she has a lot of social influence as this sort of like matriarchal figure in Hollywood and indeed in culture. And so I think that it was a very good use of her influence last night, what she did. And I thought that the speech was great. Any like leftist who would say, I don't care what she said, she's not important, is actually not really a Marxist and obviously hasn't read enough theory and doesn't understand like the importance and the significance of what she did yesterday. So, you know, I think that like more of this needs to happen. I think that everybody should have an opinion, of course. And I think everybody does have an opinion. I mean, if you look at who is our president elect, you can see that he has no decorum at all on Twitter and elsewhere and will say whatever he wants. And so why should we not say what we think? I mean, we on the left always say what we think, right? But like, why should Democratic lawmakers, you know, restrain themselves now? Like if political speech is like evolved or devolved, then why wouldn't we all actually express our opinions and, you know, engage Trump in, you know, a public debate? Like maybe now is the time to engage him in a public debate.
Right.
I'd love to see like Meryl Streep and Trump square off in a Twitter feud. I'm sure I feel pretty confident that Meryl Streep would win. I'm sure he'll take, you know, a cheap shot about her, you know, being old. I mean, that's pretty standard. We know what he'll say, right? Like you're fat, you're old, you're ugly. And then she'll just be like, well, no, I'm Meryl Streep. This is what you are, you know? So, I mean, this is what it's come to. So we kind of have to like work with what we have.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we could have a million, you know, conversations about like Twitter and how it's cheapened the political dialogue and how it's just like, you know, made people dumber or it's like dumbed down culture. But the reality is this is what we're dealing with.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I think it's, you know, I mean, I think like almost anything too, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, I know, you know this as well. I mean, you work with the Bernie campaign. I know you've been around the Pirate Party and Podemos. They've all used the internet, but it's like even something like Black Lives Matter, as someone who's been involved in so many different sort of police brutality, mass incarceration type struggles. I mean, the ability of that hashtag to catch fire, it's difficult for me to even see that level of sustained engagement on an issue that hadn't seen sustained engagement like that in, you know, 30 or 40 years without that medium that was able to just reach so many more people than sort of the traditional sort of political organizations that have been, you know, so weakened, I think, as you point out, could really possibly reach. So it's one of those things, too, where there's also that double-edged sword, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, the platform should always be a tactic, and you shouldn't, you know, you should never think of it as anything other than a tool, right? Like, and that, I think, is very important for organizers and also for, I mean, Democratic lawmakers, right? Like, they need to actually start thinking about, like, how they can better use the platform of Twitter and of Facebook and other social media platforms while they still can, because I'm not even sure how, you know, that would look under a Trump administration as they move to, you know, gut some of the protections of the free and open internet, like net neutrality, which is something that Trump wants to, he doesn't even understand what it is. Mm-hmm. Like, he doesn't know what, he, like, Trump has no idea what net neutrality is, but, you know, the people who are really running the shadow cabinet, the government, they know what that is. And so they don't really, I don't think they ever expected that the internet would be a place where people could come together and one, get woke, and two, start to organize. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that that's not what they expected. I think that like they just wanted people to, and this, you know, this includes Facebook. Like, they just, you know, their business plan is one where they wanted people to become consumers. Mm-hmm. They could market things to them, right? Like, I think in 2011, 2012, Facebook just, you know, saw an opportunity to undercut, you know, Madison Avenue agencies,
right,
by becoming a marketing platform for brands and products. And while that has happened for Facebook and generated a very, you know, healthy, robust revenue stream that has ensured that their shareholders and their board members are you know, millionaires and billionaires. They probably didn't expect that, you know, millions of people would start to use Facebook to share information, to comment, you know, to bully, to do all the things, you know, to help Donald Trump win the election, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, what are we going to do now? We have no choice but to keep using these platforms. But, you know, we have to be hypervigilant, you know, to what is actually next and be aware of, like, what we have to pivot to when we have to.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's a good point.
Like, we have to play defense now.
Sure. No, I think it's a good point. And you know, it raises sort of another issue, too, is I also think it's important, at least in my own mind, when we have the conception of sort of the quote-unquote new media, social media landscape, that we don't give the old media a pass. I mean, one of the things I was thinking about yesterday talking to someone is, like, I almost want to do, like, an anti-talking head campaign. Because, I mean, beyond anything else, like, I often find I'm less upset at, like, the CNNs or whatever for, like, covering or not covering an issue, less because they just, like, never covered it, but more because they just have these sort of, like, self-appointed people. Like, for every one Mark Lamont Hill, there's just, like, five random people who, like, worked on, you know, happened to be black and worked on Capitol Hill who are now all of a sudden, like, explaining what Black Lives Matter means for the political conversation. And it just sort of seems like, well, wait a second. Like, these media, they know who's really in the street. They know who's because, you know, they called, you know, the me and you. They know how to reach you when you need to, and that to some degree we shouldn't give them a pass on just, like, lining up a bunch of people with healthy contracts who aren't really that connected to the streets. Maybe it'll make no difference at all, but it just seems like at the end of the day, like, they shouldn't be allowed to just play the gatekeeper role without anyone saying, like, well, wait a second, why don't you bring in people who are really there to talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, this is a question I think that requires a show devoted entirely almost to the topic. But let me try to see if I can be succinct and brief here in my response. I think that it's not about, like, Mark Lamont Hill being kind of, you know, shuffled onto the set to talk about, like, black people on the streets. It's about the script. Mm-hmm. And it's about Mark Lamont Hill not, you know, talking about poverty in America, right? Or any of the people in cable news, like, being empowered by their executive board or the network brass or the advertisers to talk about a script that really is the crisis, you know. So they actually never talk about the issues, the struggle, right? You never hear about, like, poverty in America as it affects white people and black people and Asian people and Native American people. It just, that's never the story. And that should be the story. And that is a very salient point that Bernie Sanders made during the campaign, right? He at every opportunity that he had to go on cable news, he would talk about poverty in America. And he still has those opportunities to go on cable news. And in fact, I've been on cable news, and it wasn't, like, Joy Ann Reid's, like, favorite interview ever when I wanted to talk about, like, taxation in America at 10 a.m. and about the corporate tax loophole. You know, that wasn't really what they wanted their Sunday morning viewers to hear about, right? Like, that's, they're like, no, that's not going to work, right? Like, so I think it's about advertisers, and it's about, you know, how they, corporations, and how they actually control the narrative and, like, what is actually permissible for, you know, kind of public broadcast. But you also see a lot of new media outlets that are actually addressing the crises in a way that is pretty good. I mean, it could always use improvement. But I mean, I think that, like, you know, now this is doing a phenomenal job of telling stories around Standing Rock and also around really what's wrong with democracy and the crisis of capitalism, without explicitly using the word capitalism, right? So they're doing better work, and I think they would be considered a new media outlet, but they're definitely a media outlet that I watch closely, and I'm appreciative that they exist. I think Vice is actually doing some really good work, and of course, you know, outlets like The Guardian continue to do, like, quality investigative journalism, right? Mm-hmm. Like, CNN is not journalism. I mean, some of the stories are considered journalism. I think, like, Brian Stetler does okay work, you know, when he has to, around, like, well, what did happen on election night? And he's like, you know, kind of giving, like, a rundown of, like, what happened. But, like, they're not, like, going into Flint and doing, like, a special report on Flint, and they should be doing it every day, right?
Right.
But they're not. You know, there should be, like, a CNN crew inside Flint, like, every day for, like, ever.
Right.
Until those pipes get rebuilt. But that's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. And I think speaking to the role of advertisers is so huge, too, as well, because to me, it is just, like, not even true that there's no, like, if you, like, if all the time they spent, like, showing empty podiums and talking about the same story every hour, they had, like, 20 minutes on Flint, I think people would watch that. And I think over time, absolutely, it would create a niche. It just might not create a niche that you can, like, sell stuff to.
Sure. And if they wanted me to go on cable news to talk about the crisis in Flint, I'd happily do that. I'd happily talk about the crisis anywhere in the world, actually, mm-hmm, right? The crisis of capitalism happening anywhere in the world in a cogent and compelling way. I think the readers would be like, this is great. Like, let's hire her to be a pundit. But like, that doesn't sell.
Right.
Of course that doesn't sell. Like, they would cut the segment in under 30 seconds if I launched into, you know, my usual talking points, which are not talking points at all,
mm-hmm,
because they're facts, actually. And so, but you know, when your listeners like hear this clip, they'll be like, wow, like that was great. You know,
right,
like
right.
When I listen to your show, I'm like, wow, that's great. You know, when I listen to, you know, Amy Goodman's show, I'm like, wow, that was so great. Right. But like, cable news is not in good shape. And, you know, CNN is sending the worst message by hiring Megyn Kelly and saying, you know what, we're hyper normalizing white supremacy.
Right. No, I think that is the case. We are going to have to put a pin in it there. That was Winnie Wong with us again. This is, as always, By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're continuing to talk a little bit more about things coming up in the near future, both the inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump, what we're seeing in terms of pop culture and some of its relationship to resistance, and some of the continued obfuscation around what exactly did cause the loss of Hillary Clinton in the elections. And we are very happy to be joined in this conversation by Aurelia Williams, who's a student down at Georgia State in Atlanta and just an all-purpose social justice activist, does a lot of great stuff, frequent guest on the show, Mr. Bob Schlehuber, who is a news analyst here at Sputnik, and Sean Blackman from the Stop Police Terror Project DC. Thank you all for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
So I will start, I guess, with, I don't know if it is the issue of the day, actually, the Golden Globes is the issue of the day, but the inauguration, I think, is something that a lot of people are looking to. We're roughly 10-ish days away from the inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump. Really, I'll start with you. I don't know. It seems to me that this is going to really just be like the starting gun of four straight years of just sort of straight up resistance, and that what we'll see at the inauguration will really be perhaps a microcosm of what we'll see. But, you know, you're there in Atlanta. You're doing a lot of movement work around the movement for Black Lives and other things. I mean, what's the mentality of people that you are around? I mean, is it a resistance mentality that sort of once the gun is fired on January 20th, people are out the gate? Or is there some people maybe been a little back-footed by Trump getting in there?
I think so. I think empirically we've seen that all people need is a spark and then they're ready to go. Like when he was first elected, I know Atlanta was up in arms for like a week. People were protesting every single night. I think that's calmed down a little bit, but the sentiment is definitely still there. I mean, a majority of people are not happy about Donald Trump being their president. When we have pictures and like t-shirts selling out saying not my president and like F Donald Trump, when we have pop culture being shaped around that, when we have popular songs, it's very clear that the sentiment is not positive towards Donald Trump. And I definitely think that the protests on the inauguration will definitely give people the go-ahead they're looking for to just start mobilizing in a massive way. I definitely think it'll set the precedent of people, of like the return of true protest culture in this country. It's kind of like the 70s all over again, where it's like now if you're mad, you can go out to the streets and do something about it. You know, you don't just have to tweet about it. You don't just have to be on Facebook about it. You can actually go out and like march in the streets. And I think definitely Donald Trump is universally just bad enough to where people will absolutely do it. I think the inauguration is definitely going to see us set off a lot of sparks around the country and probably around the world.
Sean Blackman, you are with the Stop Police Terror Project DC. I know that you all will be out on the inaugural route with the Answer Coalition and other organizations. I know have a big setup down at Navy Memorial and will be out there. I mean, as a group that sort of emerged from the crucible of the murder of Michael Brown into the movement for Black Lives, I mean, why was it so important to be, you know, a part of these inaugural protests and right there on the route in Trump's face when he comes by, unless, you know, he's too scared to come by?
Right. Well, we felt it was our duty to be present at the inauguration, basically because of the sort of draconian things that Trump is proposing and sort of the people he's surrounding himself with, who we know have terrible track records in terms of civil rights and civil liberties and things of that nature. And not so long ago, we also saw, you know, that that list from the Fraternal Order of the Police. And we know that he's been really quite friendly with them, which is more than a little concerning. And we also remember, you know, his call for a nationwide stop and frisk. So if we feel that, you know, these things move forward, then we think we're looking at a whole new level of repression against the movement, more so than we've seen already. And we're looking at, you know, a possible, you know, a skyrocketing levels of outright terror in the streets against the oppressed people in this country.
Mm-hmm. You know, Bob, I don't know how you're seeing this. I mean, obviously, whatever happens, there'll be some story of how people were opposed to Donald Trump there at the inauguration. I mean, do you think this is just going to be sort of a blip and who knows what'll happen? It's really sort of the post-inaugural, or do you think it really – things are happening either way and this is just going to be a surfacing of some of the organizing that's already on underway?
You know, you hope it's a surfacing. I think the ultimate takeaway of these events and afterwards is who gets to set the new narrative or set the tone going out of it. We saw that the Women's March on Washington in its initial kind of genesis had a lot of problems, right? It was ultimately a few white progressive people who had co-opted the name of the march that was led by African-American women here in the 90s, and they ultimately changed it, got new co-chairs, they renamed it and rebranded it and made some corrections. But ultimately, if it ends up being a lot of the centrist liberals who had, in my opinion, kind of foreshadowing what we're going to talk about probably later, is that that's who cost Clinton the election by moving too far to the right. So now if you get a bunch of Democrats and anti-Trump protesters vocalizing their opposition, and now they're going to set the new narrative or set the new tone or the new platform or the new policies moving forward. But if it's not framed through a marginalized lens, does anything change? And do we ultimately just kind of march and make a lot of noise? And then we're not going to actually overthrow or change or critically examine the current political systems that have failed us right now. The marches and protests ultimately are going to be for naught.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's certainly a good point. I mean, I think that certainly, Aurelia, that is to some degree, one of the key questions, right? Which is, you know, what does it take to build sort of a durable resistance? I mean, obviously you need marches and protests and rallies, but you need sort of a whole broader infrastructure from media on down. I mean, you know, you all in Atlanta, I know with the ATL's Ready crew, I think have done a pretty good job at all of those things and have sustained, you know, over time, starting last summer, a pretty significant movement infrastructure there that, you know, sort of even though it was hated and denounced by many of the local political leaders, you know, has obviously been embraced by many people in the local Atlanta area. So I wonder if you had thoughts on what Bob just mentioned.
Well, first of all, thank you. We worked really hard on that. And I think infrastructure, honestly, at the end of the day, relies on the energy of young people in particular. I know a lot of movement work here in Atlanta would just not get done if it wasn't for just the straight up grunt legwork of young people, because a lot of movements just run out of energy, and young people are so great at just like injecting some vitality back into a movement. Like we're seeing this rebirth of like civil rights movements, and that's because the young people that are coming of age in this time, you know, like we've studied everything and we're definitely injecting some energy into a movement that had gotten a little stale. That being said, young people don't have the experience that some of our elders do. So to really, in my opinion, make a sustaining, effective movement, it really requires, number one, the wisdom and infrastructure of elders, but number two, space for young people to recreate the next part of the movement. It's kind of like this train that's rocketing towards our goals, but we have to constantly be rebuilding the cars because they break down because we're just going so fast. And as long as the elders continue steering the train, the young people will continue to rebuild the cars in front of us. It's like in those cartoons where the train was going and like it would set up the tracks in front of itself with its little arms. That's how a movement works, in my opinion, because movements are way out of control and can't just be managed by a single person or even a group of people. It really relies on the convergence of everything that makes a movement strong. That's why intersectional movements will always have better infrastructure and will always last longer.
Yeah, you know, Sean, let me switch gears here. You know, as both an activist and a musician, shout out Marching 100, Florida A&M University. You know, I wonder how you're reacting to, you know, not just the Meryl Streep thing, although if you want to speak specifically to what she said, I don't know if you watch the Golden Globes, feel free. But, I mean, you know, whether it's Meryl Streep, whether it's Colin Kaepernick, whether it's, you know, Misha Barton, I mean, whoever. I mean, it just seems like there was all sorts of you know, celebrities coming out and saying positive things, or I view them as positive things politically. I mean, is this something that you think is a good sign, a sign that resistance is becoming more relevant? Or is it really just like, you know, everyone is saying hashtag Black Lives Matter, so if you're a famous person, you just don't want to be, you know, behind the pop culture or whatever, or what you perceive it as?
Right. Well, Hurst, I actually would like to say one last thing on the Trump piece.
Please.
I also think that his incoming administration, I think it's going to signal a rise in consciousness around the need for organization. You see what I mean? And that's just to build off the last two comments, that youthful energy that she was talking about, that first sort of drive, that sort of, I guess, like mushroom cloud of fervor that was around when Trump first began. Thing is, a lot of that can taper off because, you know what I'm saying, folks feel like after a while they have no place for that to go. That, you know, they demonstrate for a while and they kind of don't know what else to do. But if we have, you know, political homes for folks and we start organizations that kind of keep things going on an ongoing basis, then that's one of the best ways you can sustain a movement. Now, on the flip side of that, I've also seen some cynicism in folks. You know, they're anti-Trump and their thing is, well, you know, this is the number one thing I hear, like, you can't stop him from going in. Or, you know, he's already been elected, so what do you intend to do? It's like this fatalist thing. It's like people have already given up, some folks, just because, you know, he's been elected. But I think as organizers, it's a part of our duty to make folks understand that, like, you're not powerless in all this. You don't just have to sit back and grin and bear it for 4 years. You can actively fight against the things about this administration that you don't like.
Yeah. And this is why, to me, it's so important to study history and to know what you're talking about. I was reading the other day something about the civil rights movement and when Bob Moses first went into Mississippi to organize voters. And I think it was Sunflower County or somewhere like that, where he was. There was not one black person alive in the area that could remember the last time a black person had been allowed to vote. And everyone there was so, you know, they were afraid to do it because they know they'd be assassinated by Ku Klux Klan terrorists. And I'm just thinking, and not only that, but like they did get the right to vote. I mean, it was like one dude in the middle of nowhere with a huge terrorist organization trying to kill anyone trying to do this thing where most of the people were too afraid to even speak up or stand up, and they succeeded. And we're not in that situation. It really is just doesn't really make sense to me. But Bob, I wonder what you think. I mean, we'll certainly speak to that if you want, but also this sort of pop culture move.
No, I guess to go biblical on all of us real
do
quick,
it.
I think I always like the story about when the disciples came up to Jesus and they said, why do you always talk in parables? And he goes, well, if I just told them, people wouldn't listen, right? They needed those stories. So I don't put much faith and stock into these celebrities and these actors and actresses, the speeches themselves. I think go make a movie, right? I think the movie has a powerful, much more powerful storytelling way to encapsulate audiences and to shift them and to let them find the answers themselves, where I don't think a lot of people listen, or it feels good to have these like Meryl Streep stuff today and it will spur some conversation. But I think if she made a movie that spoke to the things she talked about, that's going to have a much larger impact. I had a chance recently to read this play called The Exonerated, which was staged in the early 2000s. And they had shown this play that combined the story of six people who were on death row who were later exonerated. And they showed this play for George Ryan, the governor of Illinois at the time. And after watching it, he was so moved by the piece that he lost faith in the state's penal system, and he ended up commuting the death sentence of 167 prisoners. So art and theater and movies do have this super amazing, powerful way to move people, to change policy, to shift it. But it has to be, I think, in the artistic form as opposed to the speech. So sure, all the celebrities can continue to talk about all this stuff. It's going to make no difference. I think it's lost in the wind. But let's see what type of art comes out. And I think we're going to see some amazing art. Art comes from dark places. Often the best art comes from these places, and I think we're going to be in some dark times in the next year or two that we're going to see some very critical examinations, some really critical art pieces getting produced. Unfortunately, they're getting produced because it is a dark time, but I think we're going to see some amazing stuff the next few years.
Mm-hmm. Well, and really, I mean, you spoke to that. I mean, what role in organizing to some degree does cultural production have? I mean, beyond what Hollywood is going to do, what about what we're going to do?
Oh, my gosh. I think that definitely, like, specifically Black art is one of the most, like, it's definitely revolutionary kindling for the fire. 2016 was definitely a huge pop culture year for amazing Black art. Like, we had Beyonce release an album. We had Solange release an album. We had Chance the Rapper. Like, we had all these amazing Black artists who kind of like gave us the hug that we needed in 2016. And I am definitely excited to see who in 2017 steps up to that plate and is like, hey, here's the hug that you need, but also here's a little ammunition because you guys need to get out on your feet and get to the street. And I think especially for young people, when we have these pop culture moves, it gets us having conversations that we haven't ever had before. Like, no matter my personal opinion or thoughts on Colin Kaepernick, a lot of people were talking about what he had to say. And that is very, very important. I think celebrities using their status to bring light to important issues is incredibly important. I do agree with Bob that, like, making art about it is more helpful, but I definitely have to appreciate what Meryl Streep has said because it is trending and because it reminds people not to grow complacent. If we see these celebrities who, like, we place on such high pedestals not growing complacent, even in the midst of their glamorous lifestyles and, like, all their wealth, and we view their lives as perfect, if these perfect people aren't growing complacent, why the hell am I? Mm. You know? So it's like, I really love what that does for young, for anybody really, when celebrities step up and speak out on, like, important issues. I think it's really important.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with you. I certainly remember this. I don't know if this, I don't want to say it's before your time. You were certainly alive, but Adrian Brody did this around the war in Iraq in 2003, I believe it was, when he'd gotten the Academy Award for The Pianist and gave a great speech against the war. And they tried to actually, like, turn the music on and cut to commercial. And he was like, no, you can't cut to commercial. This is so important. And everyone started cheering him, and he continued and did the whole thing. But nevertheless, Bob, let me switch gears here a little bit. The other big news that came across the wire over the course of this weekend was the ODNI report on Russia's alleged influence into the elections. I mean, it was more or less the exact same information that was already out there, so it didn't really advance the ball, whether you think Russia did it or think they didn't do it. And I've seen many people who have been aggressively anti-Russia ripping, actually, the report, saying, well, you didn't even show us anything. So regardless of how you feel on the issue, it didn't really seem like that thing advanced the ball at all.
No, it was a problem on a few different levels. I think on one side, the stuff they did put in the report that RT, for example, their hosts are encouraged to have Twitter accounts. It was like that's what the NSA, CIA, and FBI spent the time on over their weeks of investigations to tell us that, like, hosts of major television shows have Twitter accounts to push their stories and agendas. Obviously, all of that's a problem that people can go and read, that there's so many other points that are there. But also the fact that the FBI, NSA, and CIA are all of a sudden, like, trusted entities amongst lefts and liberals is wild to me. And if anybody really actually influenced the election, it was James Comey and the FBI, like, 4 days before, saying, hey, we're reopening the investigation through the Anthony Weiner investigation. But if that wasn't shady, or if that didn't cause more disruption than the DNC leaks, which really ultimately didn't tell us anything beyond stuff that people knew just to the depths and gave some names to it as well. And obviously we talked a little bit about James Clapper, who had perjured himself, lying that they weren't spying on Senate members, and then he's going to all of a sudden be trusted to give the Senate reports. None of it made sense to me. It's just so bizarre, the world we're living in right now.
No, I think that's it's a very good point. We've only got a minute left, but I wanted to get this in because I think what you're saying there is super relevant, because the stuff they had on RT, too, was 5 years old. And when you look at the reality of the situation, all the things they were negatively pointing to was RT reporting on progressive political
issues.
RT
saying, oh, America, they keep on harping about America's undemocratic by talking about how undemocratic the Electoral College is, which is what everybody
right. And that there's anti-fracking movements, at the same time, like, and that police brutality is too focused on.
The Occupy movement was an elitist movement. Again, yeah. Which is everybody was saying. I mean, it's just like the craziest stuff.
And at the end of the day, the only people being hurt are progressive people. Like, Russia is not being hurt by this. Like, if you look at their response, they're just mocking the United States. But now a huge range of progressive opinion and progressive websites are, like, allegedly propaganda or whatever it may be. But, you know, it is what it is. Ultimately, we're going to have to leave it there today on By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. As always, I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By any means necessary.